Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Castorbas. My name is Christian Corley. I'm joined by my co-host, James McLean, this week. We have a few little bits and bobs to talk about. There's some serious stuff as well. It's quite sad news, really. We've heard a few hours ago about the passing of Red Dwarf co-creator Rob Grant, which a bit of a surprise. He seemed to be quite active very recently, and indeed he's writing a book with Andrew Marshall, or he has been writing a book with Andrew Marshall, a new Red Dwarf book. So this came as a bit of a surprise, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't think anyone was really expecting it, but I suppose it's one of those, I don't know, cult icons, which, because they're sort of icons of your youth, you expect to be indefinite. I don't know. I just wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, it's as I say, it did come along as a bit of a surprise. There is, unsurprisingly, a lot of Red Dwarf chat on social networks today. I noticed that there was a post from Craig Charles, which I thought was worth having a look at.
Yeah.
If I can just bring that up, because it's the one thing I don't have ready to look at. There we go. And he's tweeted, earlier today I was informed of the passing of @RealRobGrant. I am in total shock. He was one of the funniest people I've ever met. A visionary. My heart goes out to his family and friends. The impact he and Doug had on the course of my life is immeasurable. And I think there was some talk of another Red Dwarf special, which has apparently been recently cancelled. I find it fascinating that this whole thing, it's almost a Red Dwarf thing in itself, I suppose, in some ways. Like this notion that I had a few days ago that Rob Grant had suddenly just appeared back in my consciousness. I found out about the book that he's writing with Andrew Marshall, who's the comedy writer, wrote lots of Poirot and 2.4 Children. And then he passes away. It's strange how this sort of cyclical attention thing happens in life, isn't it? You become aware of something and then something happens about it and then it goes again.
Yeah, it just makes you think of all the things which doesn't happen about the things you think about, which don't carry those connections. All those other producers and writers you were thinking about that day, which haven't passed, and so, you know, has not become such an impact as the one who suddenly has come up in the news and you're now making that association. I mean, with Rob Grant, I was a little more aware of him a couple of years back when there was, once again, I mean, his relationship with Red Dwarf has been curious, I think we would say. I mean, as people know, he was part of the initial writing team with Doug Naylor, and then he split with Doug Naylor in terms of as writing teams, and kind of essentially left Red Dwarf. And Doug Naylor carried it on through into the Dave specials. And then a couple of years ago, there was this big announcement that they were kind of both be working on Red Dwarf, but separately. And it would almost split. And I think even like cast member related outputs could see a split as well. I think there was a conversation at the time that almost like be like two timelines. It was a really weird... Yes. But I mean, this wasn't new because they'd done this with the books as well. When they had the books in the 1990, they had split and had literally alternate versions of Red Dwarf, essentially in book forms. You could read Doug Naylor's or you could read Rob Grant's, as I remember. So yeah, I find that the most interesting thing about, that's a rude thing, obviously, because I don't know him, so I can't say what was more interesting, but from a public perspective, was this sort of weird, fractious relationship that was continuing with the Red Dwarf property with him. I got the impression that he had, for whatever reason, had decided that he wanted to be involved again, but clearly they didn't want to be involved in a way where they worked together. And so there was going to be this odd split, which I'm not sure if it had continued would have been as good for the franchise as they were with the initial announcements were suggesting it would be. I just don't think that kind of work. Well, I could be wrong. In this multiversal age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I know it's a sort of very impersonal thing to say, I guess, but I am kind of interested to see what happens with Red Dwarf now, with that having them sort of almost, like you say, they sort of found this balance of what they were going to do, but this balance doesn't seem to really massively, has not visibly paid off, apart from the fact that we knew there was a couple of things in the work and maybe some things which are no longer in the works. How does that shift the playing field for the franchise now one of its co-creators has passed?
Yeah.
And where does it go from there? And like I said, I don't mean that as any disrespect to Rob Grant. I know very little from him apart from the interviews that he would contribute to in terms of like the Red Dwarf documentaries that they would do alongside the DVDs. Yep. So, yeah, I feel as much as I can offer on this subject is probably more of a query on like, what does this mean for the franchise?
Well, in terms of the book has a cover and it's not due out until July. So that would seem to suggest to me that it's in some form of advanced edit stage.
Yes.
So that's, in terms of being a Red Dwarf fan and having something like a last contribution
absolutely.
From Rob Grant, that's good news for fans, yeah. Red Dwarf, going back to the actual show itself, I was chatting with some friends recently. I couldn't remember if I'd watched Red Dwarf the first time around. I wasn't sure if there was, like, if the first series got repeated before the second series or not. Based on the conversations I was having, we watched it when it first came out, because it was one of those Thursday night shows, like regular comedy slot on BBC Two. But I remember not really gelling with it. It was more like something I wanted to watch because it was sci-fi and it was comedy, rather than find it absolutely hilarious until really the second series.
Yeah.
How did you feel when it came out? Was that the same with you?
I remember watching very vividly now, looking back, the final episode of season one was, I think, my first entry into it. I think it was Me Squared. I think that was my first one. And then coming into it for season two, and then, as you say, when they came back and did a series one repeat later on, which, as I recall, they didn't really want to do, because a bit like with Blackadder, the two productions hate their first series quite.
I love the Blackadder.
Yeah, I love the Blackadder. I really love the first series of Red Dwarf, and we talked about this when I did the interview podcast on Red Dwarf, you know, a couple of years ago. I really like that first series of Red Dwarf. I love this scaled back, pure sitcom, you know, porridge almost like approach to it. Yeah. I think it really works. It shocks me when I see things like Waiting for God, which, while not perfect, you know, a lot, I think people involved in it and some of the people right around it really hate. And I really love that episode. I think it's got a lovely bit with the, I think it's the bit with the cat and his blind priest is really nicely done and vaguely poignant in a weird way. You've got this wonderful, inane and going nowhere a spine to the story of the Quagars and Rimmer's fascination with the garbage pod. There's a lot of fun stuff in there. And while I like where, you know, I kind of enjoy where season three onwards went in some ways, I kind of felt you lose something that was there in that sort of initial, in that initial phase, you know, because I don't know, action sometimes can just lead, it dials everything back a bit. Mm. It dials back the sort of characterizations back a bit, because you're now dealing with sort of more conceptual or adversary stuff. But I mean, yeah, I've always had a strong love for Red Dwarf and I've followed it all the way through to its, you know, recent iteration. I don't find it as sharp as it was, maybe. And I don't think that's necessarily because, you know, you sometimes when you get used to something, it becomes less. I just don't think it's quite as sharp as it was.
Yeah.
I think there's a terrible things for comedians, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but I tend to find, by and large, comedy is sharpest with younger comedians. When comedians are young, their timing, their edge always seems to be far more there than it does when they get older.
I think there's more to say when you're younger, isn't there? You've got sort of 20 years of frustration to...
Possibly. I don't know. I'm not sure what it is. I think Rimmer was always... And maybe part of it is that when they're younger as well, they're playing with a brand new character where they don't know the directions, they don't know the envelope of where they're going with it. So it's perhaps a little more unpredictable. While later, I mean, Rimmer's a good example of this. I think Rimmer's far stronger in the earlier series than he is in the later series, or even especially in the Dave series. And I think part of that is because the audience have come to expect what he is, and I think the actors come to expect what he is, and so has the writers. And the envelope seems to sort of constrain them a bit. Mm. While, you know, I mean, I just remember, I think it must have been season 5, where there's the Rimmer recounting his game of Risk to Lister. And he's just going through the dice rolls, and, you know, Lister's trying to say, I'm not interested, and he just can't see it. And there's just something really, really believable about that interaction. And I think, yeah, there's sort of like an authenticity of characters, I think, in those earlier series, which kind of almost becomes a little more, I don't know what the word is this morning. I'm struggling this morning to find my words. A little more archetypal, that they sort of start to fall into the sort of standard conventions of that character. A bit like Friends, you know, when in the early episodes of Friends, I've no real love for Friends anymore. You know, Monica was actually quite a well-rounded character. By the end of it, it's all about her being meticulously about being bossy and clean, and that's kind of all that sort of drives her by that point.
And competitive,
yeah. So everything, characters end up being kind of reductive and reduced down to their sort of key components. While early, I don't know, yeah, but those early seasons were good. I liked them, and I think I particularly liked it when the two of them were writing together. I think they balanced each other's material out well. Absolutely. I think Doug carried it on extremely well, especially since, you know, it's now one of the longest running British sci-fi comedy. Well, there's not many sci-fi comedies.
Yeah.
But in essence, it's still going in various forms. But yeah, I think it was definitely best when I kind of find that it's odd, isn't it, that with UK comedy, because it doesn't translate so much into the US. Comedy writing teams are far more of a thing, or have been historically.
Yeah.
And it always strikes me that approach seems to work so much better than when they sort of split, or when you have single writers. The two always seem to...
Yeah, I think I think there's been a handful of like one-offs where they've used teams, rooms. The only one that really, I think, that had any real impact in the UK that relied on the US method was My Family, which was spearheaded by US writers in the first place. They got US writers in to start writing My Family. So, and of course, that did tail off. Probably, I mean, that outlived its welcome by about 5 series, I would think. But around the time Chris Marshall left, I think, really, is when it kind of went off the boil. But if it was ever on the boil, but you know, when you've got big characters in that, it makes it compelling watching, doesn't it? And then when they leave, you're kind of less interested in watching.
But it also makes you wonder what each brings to the table when you've got the duo. I mean, going back to Blackadder, where you've got Curtis and Elton as kind of the staples from the second series onwards. Again, you think, you know, Ben Elton's humour to Curtis's, they're very different types of people and very different types of humour, and the sort of mesh of the two works fairly well. You know, again, going back to Father Ted, Matthews and Linehan together were a very strong force. I think stronger than... I personally think strong. There goes an object off my table, randomly.
An opposing force.
Specifically Ian Chesterton. A signed photo of Ian Chesterton just falled off my table. Yeah, just to give it a bit of a Doctor Who edge to this.
Well, we'll be getting a Doctor Who edge in a moment. In terms of writers now, because the other thing, and I don't know if this is the case with Red Dwarf, but we'll talk about Blackadder, is that certainly with Blackadder's series, Blackadder Goes Forth, I've seen it written many times latterly that the stars were contributing heavily to the script. Yeah. And I wonder if that's the same thing with Red Dwarf. Certainly in terms of Chris Barry.
I don't know with Red Dwarf. I know Red Dwarf, its stars and its writing team, or its production, at times had occasionally fractious relationships. Danny John-Jules and Craig Charles were infamous for turning up late. And no matter how they tried to sort that out, Danny John-Jules was always late. You know, I think, you know, one of the reasons they moved site was a bit, you know, to try and control the team better. And, you know, they had to start getting buses rather than planes because they weren't turning up. I mean, there was all sorts of things. I'm not sure how much they naturally contributed. I mean, obviously, some of them contributed behind the scenes. You know, Llewellyn did some directing. But then with the Blackadder stuff, if you listen to Curtis especially, he would say that their contributions were counterintuitive in a weird way and frustrating because as a writer, you had the stuff. They'd have all your stars turn around and go, actually, this needs to be like this or we should do it like this. Can be frustrating. And yet at the same time, you know, the problem is all those stars are writers in some off, you know, comedy writers. So it's not surprising that they might turn around after years of experience, but I can get why that sort of paradigm of writing of creativity can become frustrating and one you don't really want to go back to when you've got that sort of situation. I don't get the impression Red Dwarf had quite that. But yeah, it's a funny show. It's a funny show in so many ways. And in part, like we said, going back to it, it's this weird division in the writing team. I mean, what other show has like two versions of its novels having two different continuities? I mean, that's so bizarre.
Yeah.
And both of them were pretty good, as I recall. I read them back in the 90s. I've not read them since. But Naylor and Grant's it was interesting to read them. And they were also different, tangential from the show canon as well. They retold. But then the show canon was never stable too. There's some wonderful fan theories, we might have talked about it before, around, you know, like the changing of Kachansky, Lister's girlfriend, and how that, you know, there's just some weird, and a lot of this comes is from a show which has always put its comedy first and its continuity second, which is very British, a bit like Doctor Who, really, touching on that.
Well, let's move on to Doctor Who. I shared with you last evening, Jonathan Helm, who contributes to Doctor Who magazine, has a Substack. He's also, I found him via X, formerly Twitter. And he mainly focuses on Blake 7, but he's done a feature on Sharda. This is available to read on Substack, in which he goes pretty deep into the model shots and the model shots that were done and the model shots that weren't done. And there's lots of really interesting stuff in there. You know, we've talked about Sharda before. It is a kind of, it's almost a gift that keeps on giving in terms of material. Some of this stuff I've seen before, some of it I haven't. But I was really interested in the CGI work he's done in order to recreate some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's weird. It's like a gift which keeps on giving but never actually gives you what you want. It's almost like someone almost giving you the present and you keep reaching for it because it looks nice, but they never quite give it to you because it will never be complete. It'll never, in various forms that they've completed it, it's still not really complete. It's still not what it's. So Sharda, I always find a sort of very frustrating concept, which I never really gel with because it's just not really there. And while I've watched some of the various attempts to retell it, you know, in some ways quite creative ways, if we look at the Big Finish attempt with Paul McGann and Lalla Ward, but nevertheless, you're right, I think having, you know, just from a production point of view, seeing the various pieces of work, and also sometimes just like I find interesting looking, like, you know, visual effects requirements and just seeing a typed out sheets of just basically what they think they're going to need.
Yes.
A list of assets. I do really like this sort of material.
I was going to say it's quite sad in some ways because, you know, the list that you mentioned there, and then the fact that they'd actually lined up shots to do model work, and then Industrial Action came in. So these models were made and shots, there's photos of them, and shots were lined up, but they didn't get to film them. That must be awful. That amount of work and effort going into something, get it all, and even you've produced it and then you've handed it off to someone else who's then lining up the shots, etc., and the lights go out.
I thought it was fascinating how it was said, you know, saying in the previous series that they had gone to film to do a lot of their effect shots to get us that far more sort of realistic look where lighting could be sort of pulled back studio light on film, and that's really good. But they get to this point and there's kind of no money left.
Yeah, so they're going to be doing it on video.
small things like that. Again, I think that is what's nice about Shada, is that Shada sort of slips out from being like an episode of the show, and it becomes almost like a production moment of the show, or an example of.
Yes.
It unravels almost like a making of Doctor Who of the time.
How it can go wrong. And really, I mean, it's not just a lesson on how it can go wrong, but it's really a lesson to us on how it has to go right. And if it goes wrong, this is what happens, which is why everyone has to be working together in order to produce something that, whether it ends up being what the writer and director have in mind, it still has to be completed. People have to get paid. It has to go to air.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of nice just to sort of see some of this. And I suppose in a weird way, it's nice seeing it in the fact that it'll never exist, no matter how many people try to recreate it.
Yeah, it's not a lost episode, is it? It's not going to turn up.
No. So in the end, it's always going to be this unraveled thread, which allows speculation and exploration with no ending point.
Yeah.
It's not like recreating something which exists. It's like sometimes recreating or something which will never exist, and or trying to find a way of understanding something which never exists. And I think it's a funny one as well, because it's such a, in a lot of ways, an un-Doctor Who like approach to the in the period Shada. It sort of exists in a space which the Tom Baker era, it's very ambitious.
Looking at what we've got and knowing the story, it is very Douglas Adams, isn't it?
Well, the nearest sibling's got to be City of Death.
Yeah.
And even that doesn't really sit with what.
Well, I mean,
it's
I was
doing.
Thinking maybe its nearest sibling's actually a completely different franchise entirely.
Yeah. So, were you thinking of one specifically, or were you just going to pick
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, it's, but also it's got that weird law bending space where you have another TARDIS, you have another Time Lord, which, you know, coming to the 80s and you'd be more expecting to see that sort of stuff, even though we really didn't. But in this point in the 70s, it feels very out of place. Everything about it feels out of place, beyond the fact that it now is out of place because it's the only one that wasn't finished. It just, as a story, feels really, and I think that's probably one of the problems with Shada is that because it has, there is no final version, but in itself, it feels so unraveled in terms of its, compared to the rest of the story. It doesn't feel like it fits.
No.
It's not like if you'd imagined, like we didn't have Underworld as a completed version, or, even City of Death, to a degree, you would feel the Doctor Who framework there. With this, as you say, you kind of don't. It feels tangential. The whole setup feels it's just a kind of weird mess of ideas and things, which is very Douglas Adams, very Hitchhikers, where it's not really got a cohesiveness to it. And yet it's the one we don't have.
I stumbled across an episode of Have I Got News For You on YouTube the other evening with Peter Cook on Ian Hislop's team, and Douglas Adams with Paul Merton. And it struck me, Douglas Adams just took every question and answered them like almost encyclopedically whilst putting in a bit of humour. And I thought that was really interesting. This was from about 1995. But the most interesting thing, I think, really was like you were on that show, and very, very few shows really these days, you don't get that, I mean, that quality of guest is immense in terms of British comedy, like the history of British comedy. Two massive names there on the same show, just chatting about the news, which is something it doesn't really do these days, that show. It is a very much a different show. But I don't want to get sidetracked by that. I do want to ask you, though, do you have a favourite version of Shada?
No, probably what's in The Five Doctors. You know, I know that's a sort of flippant answer, but at the same time, it's probably the only bits of Shada which actually feel rooted in Doctor Who. Everything else kind of goes in weird different directions. This weird, almost comic book version of thinking about Time Lords and their legacy in the prisons, and everything there just feels almost like you'd find in a Doctor Who comic book. The only bits really there which feel like Doctor Who are kind of the bits on the boat and the bits when they get in the TARDIS. And it's like, well, actually, those are the bits I probably feel the most comfortable with, because the rest I just never can quite get the feeling for. I've never read the book, I must admit.
Right. The Gareth Roberts book, I enjoyed that a lot. I think I think it felt very much at home there. It didn't feel like there was anything, like you were missing anything, or it switches to animation for this bit. There's none of that there, because it's in a completely different format, obviously, and it's all in your head. But I do like the Tom Baker reconstruction, but I do have a soft spot for the Paul McGann and Lala Ward.
I like version. The idea of it as well. I like this sort of internal commentary, which is kind of fun. And funnily enough, you just talking about previously about the sort of Rob Grant phenomenon, I was just looking at Jonathan Helm's Substack, and the activity that he's reposted was Gareth Roberts, which I've not thought about him for ages. And then, 5 minutes later.
Well, that's just crazy, again, isn't it?
just shows how these things happen, doesn't it?
Isn't it? Doesn't it? Yeah. Okay. We're going to move on now to just one last chat. Last year, we chatted to an amazing gentleman called Adrian Munsey, who has been working in... he's a polymath, isn't he, really? He's incredibly creative gentleman, and he's been around a very long time. And he produced a series of documentaries about the rocket age, the space age, etc. And it was really good talking to him. I think you did all the talking, though, didn't you?
Yes, it was an interview. We did an interview.
And he's got another series coming along. Which kind of took me by surprise when the email dropped in my inbox, called Spy Masters, which is premiering on Sky Arts this spring, in which he basically covers the entire history of modern spying, from Rudyard Kipling through James Bond to the War on Terror. Now, this is going to commence on Sky Arts on Tuesday, 31st of March, and is on weekly after that. It's 4 60-minute episodes. I mean, I'm going to be looking out for it, but I'm just amazed that someone has that much energy to keep working. I mean, people I know of Mr. Munsey's generation don't do that much work. They're quite happy to just enjoy retirement. But I want to be more like Adrian when I'm an older gentleman. I want to keep working. I think it's amazing.
Don't worry. I think society will help you on that.
So, it's already planned out for us.
Yeah. We're going to be Munsied out of this world. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I think we did talk briefly about his upcoming things he was doing and the spy thing. I find spies are really interesting. I was watching, I watched this last year now, Down Cemetery Road, the second adaptation from the Slow Horses author. And one of the things I found that was weakest is that when you're on the run, and you're being chased by eight government agencies and the like, and you're still getting money out from somewhere, and you've still got there's still a phone.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, this kind of shows to me why, if you're going to do the spy genre, you've almost got to do it in the past.
In the past.
Because it's now becoming so hard to just be able to naturally do a genre, unless you're going down the sort of silly, almost sci-fi spy rabbit hole of James Bond, where you've got various technical things to prevent technical things from tracking you or the like, or you go down a more realistic spy road where it's really not that sort of thing a spy does. It's not the secret agent thing anymore.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of that exciting narrative, it's something more plodding and something more, integrated into a society or space. So I was just thinking, for the genre, I mean, again, like with James Bond, and I know we've talked about this before, how I just think you've got to do, if you do James Bond from here on, you just got to do it in the past. Because I think those trappings of the genre, I think is what I'm trying to say, cannot really exist in the modern framework of technology. And that's I was what I was again it's going slightly tangential. I was watching rewatching V, the American
the
TV
original.
Series of the '80s. Yeah, yeah, the '80s one. I've got it on DVD. The that and the Final Battle, not the TV, the miniseries and the Final Battle, not the TV series, which no. I just discount because it's not very good. But again, it's just things there when the aliens attack the rebels' base and they sort of escape out the back and then they've just escaped. And you just think, well, these days it'd be genetic trackers. They would you know, from, you know, you'd just be able to, at the very basics, you'd have drones everywhere for when they escape. So you'd be able to follow wherever they went to. You just can't do the same sort of fun spy action infiltration sort of stuff anymore.
No.
In the current, I think it's very hard unless you know the, and if you can, it's probably not that interesting to watch. So it's just interesting when I'm just thinking about less about spies is what Adrian's talking about here, but just thinking about our sort of perception of spies, which is kind of generated through things like James Bond and through thrillers. And it's a weird world to explore now.
This is that moment in the podcast where I remind you that the full podcast, ad-free and in video, should you desire it, is available on Patreon exclusively to our subscribers there. You go to patreon.com/Casterbris. You'll also get access to the Casterbris archive, which is bulging with new interviews from the archive every week. Now, if you are subscribing to Patreon, you get to hear the full podcast. That means a conversation between myself and James McLean in which I explore my reading history as a child in the realm of spy books, and James and I also go into one of our favourite topics, the current state of the streaming industry. That's what's next on Patreon, but if you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts and everywhere else you can get podcasts from, then coming up is the end of this week's show.
For stuff they're now getting kind of used to, we've had the Stranger Things model, we've had the Disney models, we've had the Star Wars models. What are the new models of event programming are they going to offer these streamers, which will keep us paying £6, £7, £8 a month? I just think maybe, again, like I said, this is probably something for another time, but
yeah,
I think it's just interesting space to be thinking
about. It is.
About
well, it is a topic that we come back to repeatedly for good reason. So I dare say we will pick up on that in the near
future. We'll probably
have
to talk about next time Doctor Who and HBO as well, because that's been a conversation
late.
Yeah,
definitely.
Just to make sure people are aware that we are aware of it.
We are aware of it.
Around to talk about it.
There is something else we're aware of as well. And this brings us back to Adrian Munsey nicely, I think. And maybe what actually Adrian Munsey is doing isn't Munseying, it's Shatnering. William Shatner... He's releasing a heavy metal album, which I think is absolutely amazing. From his post on social media last week, 35 metal virtuoso, thunderous guitars, chaos with purpose, covers of legends like Black Sabbath, Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, and a few originals forged in the same cosmic fire. This project is quite literally a gathering of forces, loud imagination, honest intensity, unapologetic exploration. At 94, one does not slow down, one turns the volume up. So prepare yourself. We are about to boldly headbang where no one has headbanged before. I love this.
There's a bit of me which really hates it at the same time, because it's another, again, it goes back to these event things. It's a really big event things, and it, and you know, it's like Shatner doesn't need the money. He's doing this because he wants to do it, which is great.
Yeah.
But you think how much other, you know, how artists find it hard to sort of break into these sort of spaces when, you know, you've got that sort of thing going around, and when you've got companies looking for big, safe, easy products.
Yeah.
They will buy up distribution of that, then they will something fresh and risky. And there's a little bit of that with, you know, 94 as well. He's been in this game for a while doing this. And I don't know. I don't like when people say, oh, you know, we just, you know, films are all just adaptations. It's all Marvel films. It's ridiculous now. And it's like, yeah, it's that because you keep going and seeing them, mate.
Because you want
That's why they're popular. Yeah. They're popular, so they're there. It's not because there's a trick in this. But at the same time, there is that feeling of when you feel there is a kind of like a wall, which in part is created by, just like with podcasts. You know, we know that we've said this before, we've been doing this now for what, 15 years or whatever. And the grassroots artisan era of podcasting is long gone. And, you know, we are talking and battling with, as we've said, Sophie Aldred, Brent Spiner, Jonathan Frakes, the Enterprise crew, Battlestar Galactica, Katie Sackhoff's long running podcast. And now she's doing commentaries for that show. And it saturates with people who are making money out of this, which we don't.
And as you related a couple of weeks ago, the bloke out of Castle and the bloke out of Dodgeball.
Yeah, exactly. And that's great. I mean, I listen to some of them as well, so I'm not knocking them. I think it's fun, it's interesting, and for fans, it's great as well. But you sometimes think about, you miss the artisan eras that sort of get lost. Like we miss the eras of the internet where you had GeoCities and Angel Fire, and you had these... everything becomes a lot more corporatized, and that's kind of how these models are doing. You have these big production distribution companies, and they're sort of bringing these people in, and they're all hubs of content producers, but they're all the same sort of thing, just from different TV shows. And again, that's great, but
well, anyway, William Shatner's album is apparently coming out this year, so I'm going to be looking forward to that. I'm going to wrap things up now. We will be back with more material for you next week. There's another interview has just dropped a few days ago on Casterbris, the Casterbris archive, beg your pardon, between Brian and Terry Molloy, which is a nice chat.
Cool.
We've also done Fraser Hines and Weddy Padbury, and Deborah Watling, and we've done Paul McGann. There's lots more to go with that. I have a couple of my own as well that haven't been widely shared that will also be joining those, along with a lot of other things. So remember to head to patreon.com/Casterbris to look at those. And there is a recent article by me, it's actually an old article that I've rewritten and updated, about the TV movie that's on our Substack, so check that out as well. Everything's in the show notes. We'll be back next time. Until then, it's goodbye from us.